What I was going to share before we came up to the news break was an interesting tidbit on predestination. You see, Augustine, who was considered a saint by Roman Catholic standards, is considered a great intellect of his time. He authored a book called City of God, and he is known for advancing the myth of predestination. He advanced predestination a long time before Calvin did. And, of course, you can't have predestination and free will. Predestination is wholly in conflict with Yahweh's testimony. Now, he was also a big proponent, in fact, actually came up with the notion of original sin so that we were all stained by what Adam had done, not by our own poor choices. And so there was a fellow living in Bethlehem who took a different approach. And he said that, as I study the Torah and prophets, I can find no evidence for predestination, and I find irrefutable evidence to the contrary. And I find no evidence of original sin. I find total evidence to the contrary. And this fellow in Bethlehem routinely cited the Torah and the prophets to prove his point. So Augustine wanted him labeled a heretic. Augustine could not defeat his arguments. And since he couldn't debate his arguments, because he was debating against God, he chose to slander the individual and had the individual labeled a heretic. The reason that came into my research this morning and yesterday is because Christians during the late 4th and early 5th centuries, when Constantine was creating the Roman Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church, he was unbelievably anti-Semitic, as were all of the church leaders at that time. And I started to quote them. I found out their homilies against Jews. And this fellow was explaining how the Jews were such savages that they would take the skins of Greeks and wear them as clothing, and just how it just goes on and on and on. And so it's interesting to see the rise of anti-Semitism that grew through both the Greek and Roman communities for different reasons, but during that period of time, and it was all related to the subject that you mentioned, Glenn, which was predestination.
I didn't intend to specifically, but yeah, we got on that for sure. God forbid we should contradict the great fornicating saint, St. Augustine. No.
Was he? I mean, it's amazing when you get into just a little bit under the surface of these individuals and you see this animosity that he had to a guy that bested him, that demonstrated that his writings about his God were inconsistent with the writings of the real God, and how Augustine thereby promoted his agenda by slandering the man, the ad hominem argument. It's really reprehensible when you get to the underbelly of Christianity and its founding fathers.
And you had tied that in before you had started to speak about the three revolts of
this one came up in the midst of the second of the three, because there is no current accounting. There is no accounting from the specific time of the second revolt, about 114 CE. So that the only two historical portraits we have of it are both written. One was by a Roman apologist and the other by a Christian apologist, both designed to demean Jews. The third, of course, that grew out of the rebellion against what Rome had done in 66 through 70 CE, when just for giggles, they were crucifying 500 Jewish civilians a day. Just for giggles. Anyway, they did it for day after day, week after week, month after month. The third, of course, is the one that was inspired by Rabbi Akiva and Bar Kokhba, where Rabbi Akiva named Bar Kokhba, son of the star, the long-awaited Messiah in the Yovel year of 133, and they came to oppose Rome too. They were also, like the rebellion in 66, effective. The Jews were the only people to effectively, as a Roman province, to effectively thwart the Romans. And so they...
Masada, was it during Bar-Kokhba?
Masada was during the 70, the 66 to 70 rebellion Masada took place. And Masada is really a meaningless footnote on the, I know Jews celebrate it today, but it's a meaningless footnote on what happened between 60 and 70 CE. And the last was between 133 and 135 CE, and that's the time when Rome salted the land, completely destroyed everything that there was, and every town in the province of Judea, and then renamed the province Philistina after their enemy. But it's a pretty horrible history. And what's interesting, when Yahweh speaks of the history of rise and fall of nations, what he's effectively saying is that he's trying to explain the nature of the beast, the nature of the adversary to humankind. And he depicts this beast arising out of these human political and religious and military institutions. And so the beast is literally the sum total of the integration of militancy, vicious militancy, religion and politics and economic schemes that were born and bred in Babylon, born cultured again by the Persian Empire, embraced again by the Macedonian Empire, and then were made to flourish. The worst of humankind, and not only in the Roman Empire, but God then goes on to say, but that beast isn't dead. That, you know, out of that beast is a menace that tramples the entire world.
And it tramples the residue and it doesn't rise back up.
Right, and that particular beast, you know, he's now when it's worldwide and it's no longer dead, he's speaking of the influence of Roman Catholicism and the Eastern Orthodox churches that were conceived by Constantine. And he goes on to say some really harsh things about what grew out of Rome. And so as you spend time affirming Yahweh's testimony and showing the vile nature of what grew out of these cultures and out of Rome, ultimately, and how those will all be embodied in the beast, it makes you pretty sick to your stomach. It's really awful.
Oh, absolutely. And one thing I always think about how bad Rome was, and then I think about Julius Caesar being taken aback by the practices of the Druids when they went into England. But that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, but keep in mind here, when and I think it's worth talking about how disgusting Rome was. Julius Caesar wrote of himself in third person. He always spoke of Caesar doing this and that. And much of what he wrote we know to be factually inaccurate. He was buffing his resume because he wanted to be considered a god. And so for him to write about what he viewed were despicable behaviors by the pagans, when he himself was among one of the most vicious, ruthless, sadistic men in human history. So the likely of it all being true is really slim. What we have found is that much of what Julius Caesar wrote was self-flattering, but hugely exaggerated.
You were talking about Daniel. Can I take just a minute to talk about his statue? In the dream of the statue, where the iron legs were Rome, and then the feet were of iron and clay.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just like speculations about the iron and clay metaphor. I'm curious your reaction. iron, you know, would represent a continuation of like an imperialism, you know, totalitarian influence. And clay, I mean, God made Adam of clay, so, and clay could be thought of as that's like government of the people.
Of man.
Mixed in with totalitarianism. That's sort of like what we're seeing today. And then also in a physical sense, iron is a conductor, clay is an insulator, and when you mix an insulator with a conductor, you get a semiconductor, and we live in the age of semiconductors. I just thought that was intriguing.
Well, that is intriguing. You know, I think there's much more to it than all of that.
In
part of the iron reference is covered here in Yeshaya 18:5, where he speaks of individuals being impervious, hardened, and unfit. Iron is hard. The Romans were universally unreceptive. They are today. Roman Catholics and Eastern Orthodox Christians are completely unreceptive to his testimony. They're hard. They're resistant. It's also a metaphor for weaponry. Weaponry is made of iron. You know, it's used to kill people. And clay has a tendency too that not only I love your point about how Adam is made for clay. It's a human institution, but as a human institution, what does clay do when it is you put a lot of pressure on it or you get it wet? It crumbles.
Mm-hmm.
And so clay is also in concert with the iron that it crumbles. And in one of the things that's also interesting is that clay, of course, has to be moist earth around iron, and what you get is rust. you get decay. So
and
all of those, I think.
So easily when the stone from heaven strikes it.
Yeah, and it's also interesting that for the most part, Gabriel, you know, it's one thing for us to look at a prophecy and now through the light of subsequent history be able to say, okay, the goat represented this and the bear represented that, and to go through it like this. But in these particular prophecies, this is the reason that those who reject Yahweh and his Torah, prophets, and Psalms have such a problem with this. Gabriel comes down at the end of the second of the two prophecies, and he says, okay, let me explain this to you. That was Greece, and he names them by name. That's Persia, and he names them by name. He says, that's a country that doesn't exist at the moment, but that's Rome. And he goes through and he names them all and explains all of the symbolisms. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Shattering Mist. We have Diane on the phone, but before I respond to Diane's comment or question, I want to tell you what my plan is. I had hoped to be able to complete Yeshaya, our review of Yeshaya 18 today. And that's still the goal here in the concluding 45 minutes of this program. After doing that, I wish to do something that will be very controversial. I received an email today from a wonderful woman who has helped immensely in the editing of Yada Yada, Questioning Paul, and Introduction to God. And she's coordinating a syndication effort on behalf of the program. And one of my very favorite people, who calls the program quite often, Kirk, let her know that in a conversation that he had with a station, it was K, which is just the standard, you know, radio designation for a station in America, K, YAH, and the manager of KYA said that he would not consider this show because he had heard that that Yada had said that the author of Ephesians was a liar. So what I'm going to do is this point into the future, I'm going to begin a presentation of Questioning Paul on this program. So our second and third hour are going to include a review of Questioning Paul. You know, in Kaya may not want to hear the truth, but for those of you who do, for those of you who have friends that are poisoned by this religion, that will be our agenda going forward. We're going to tell the truth that very few people wish to hear. That said, hello, Diane.
Hi, good morning, Yada. How are you doing?
Oh, pretty good. Well, considering what the material that I've been reviewing here, it's not exactly fun, but you know, I always enjoy the time that I get to spend with Yah when we're searching His Word.
Well, I'm with you. So my question is when I was reading, so they're coming out of Egypt into the wilderness, and mm-hmm. I have just really given a lot of ponderance to when they were talking about the snake out in the wilderness.
Yeah.
That snake wasn't like a literal snake, but that possibly Yahweh had given him the knowledge how to correct the DNA. So I was wondering what your line of thought was on that.
Oh, boy. You know, I don't know. I've translated the passage relative to the symbolism. And, obviously there's are symbols associated with the serpent and what the serpent represents and the fact that even during one of the signs in Egypt there was a serpent. It is true that God created good and evil. There wouldn't be evil in the world if God did not allow it. You can't have choice without good and evil. And it's true that God not only created Satan, but He allowed him to slither into the garden to make our decision as to whether we want to be with him or opposed to him to be real. But in terms of whether or not that was had something to do with DNA, now I didn't get there, and I'll be glad to look at it again. And if you'll send me a letter, Diane, that's a subject I will consider. But you got me there. I can't give you any insights in terms of the symbolism of the snake in DNA. What do you think, Lynn?
Well, I'm assuming she's talking about the brazen serpent that was lifted up that they gazed upon for in case bitten by a snake.
That is correct.
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah, I know it's common for people to make an analogy between that and the modern caduceus symbol of the two snakes intertwined on a pole for medicine, used for doctors in medicine. I think it's a mistake to associate those.
Boy, would I agree on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the caduceus is that's based entirely on the Greek pagan religion. I mean, that's
right.
People
saying that was that the caduceus symbol represented the double helix of DNA. Blah blah blah. I don't recommend going down that path.
Oh gosh, no. Yeah, you can't go there because of the fact that at the time that it was used, it represented a pagan god. I mean, that was the entire symbolism was a pagan god. The fact that they're intertwined, and now you look at it as okay, that could be a symbol of DNA. That's projecting back on a symbol, and when we project back like that, you're almost always led to an erroneous conclusion.
I believe that snake was later destroyed during the reforms of Hezekiah because people were it was used as an idol in Solomon's temple.
Well,
yes.
I know you're going to a break, so can I hang on?
Sure.
Thank you.
We'll be back with Shattering Myths and considering the connections between snakes and DNA. Personally, I don't think that we ought to go there. I think Glenn agrees. I suspect that that Yahweh does as well. We'll be back after the commercial break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. The passage that Diane was mentioning is found in the book called In the Wilderness. It's Bob Midbar. It is 21:9, 8 and 9, really. This is how it reads. It says, then Yahweh spoke to Moshe, make a fiery serpent and set it on a standard, and it shall come about that anyone who is bitten, when he looks at it, he will live. And Moshe made a bronze serpent and set it on the standard. And it came about that if a serpent bit a man, when he looked at the bronze serpent, he lived. Let me give you my just immediate reaction to that. And this is what I came to when I translated the passage years ago, is that Yahweh was having his children walk through a desert. And they're walking through a desert because of the fact that they were not prepared to enter the promised land. And their issue was that they had this tendency to give up on Yahweh and complain as opposed to and and had this propensity to go back to the gods of the Egyptians. And so if you're in the middle of the desert, one of the natural things going to happen is there's lots of snakes, and the snakes are poisonous, and you get bit, and if you get bit, you die. And God didn't want his children to be dying out there in the wilderness, so he says, all right, you know, this is a great way, just real simple way. I can say that, you know, I've got power even over the venom of snakes. If you look up upon this pole, you know, it says, look up, this is an upright pole right here. I've got a fiery snake here. If you look up at that pole and recognize that I can solve that problem for you, I'm going to give you a real simple means here. You get bitten by a poisonous snake, I'll resolve the issue. Just trust me. And the bigger picture of the whole thing is that the religion that God was trying to counter, which is why they were walking in the wilderness, is a poisonous snake. It's poison. And that God has a remedy, an antidote for that poison. And that's to look at upon the upright one. You know, the upright pillar is woven through the Yah's testimony. The upright pillar is the corporeal manifestation of Yah's Torah. It's Yahusha. It's God standing up for us so that we could stand with him. And so all of that is being conveyed. I didn't get anything more from it than that. And specifically, it was a single bronze serpent, so the intertwined DNA backtracking projection would be wholly invalid in that case.
Bingo.
All right. Now, Diane, you said you had another question? Hello, Diane? Oh, well,
I think
thought
she's not there.
I think that Diane is not. No, you're right. She has but Diane has our number. She can call back if she would like. I do want to go to Yeshayah 18:5-6. And by the way, before I go, Glenn, your extrapolation as to why some people are now associated with DNA because the caduceus, which was a symbol developed, you know, 1,500 years later, that's now two intertwined snakes, and how that is now looked at as representing DNA, and that's being projected on that. That was a really good insight. Thank you.
No, thank you.
Okay, indeed, God tells us, before the approaching presence of the harvest, as the budding blossoms form and become completely perfect, then the hardened and unfit will be dealt with for becoming wild birds of prey, glistening eagles and falcons and hawks. And the insignificant and the worthless who squander and trivialize will be stopped, taken down and banished, snuffed out. So then, with regard to the forsaken castaways, they will be rejected and removed, cast off and separated. Now, we reviewed that yesterday along with this next statement, but I wanted just again to put it into context because God is explaining what you'll experience in Sheol if you wish to oppose him. So they shall actually and be completely abandoned and forever forsaken, altogether, completely and all at once for the birds of prey in high places. And for the beasts of the realm. So he's speaking of fellow elitist, leaders, those who are conspiring against the people, and the beasts are demons. And they will be abruptly awakened in the summer. You know, as you mentioned, Glenn, mortals die. But mortals don't necessarily stay dead. There are two ways to be revived. One is, they said, these are going to be abruptly awakened in the summer, and they're going to find vexing and exasperating action taken against them. They're now in Sheol. They're getting to rub the shoulders with all of the big boys of past religious and political and military lore. All manner of birds and prey, and also every kind of beast of the realm will be among them, against them. During the autumn and the winter, continually ridiculing and taunting them for being irrational and consistently confused. You know, there's a lot of folks that say, you know, that the elitists, whether they be bankers or pharmaceutical companies or their military industrialists or their politicians or their bankers or whatever they may be, that these elitists are conspiring to control the world. And to whatever degree that is true, what God is saying here is that it isn't going to work out very well for them. that they're going to find themselves amongst their brethren, and that their brethren aren't going to like the situation much either, and they're all going to be put into the same pool, and the very demons that they either knowingly or unknowingly leagued with are going to be the ones mocking them. You know, so the ones that mocked everyone are now going to be mocked. And they're saying, how could you have been so stupid? I mean, really? Yeah, what you were trying to do here was irrational. Why would you do so? So, you know, in Sheol, the inmates, if you will, in the black hole are going to be forever forsaken. And it's important to recognize here how different Sheol is from either the Christian or Islamic projection of the place. In Islam, Allah spends all of his time in hell tormenting unbelievers. And the graphic depictions in the Quran are just morbid. I mean, they're just sadistic. You know, he rips off people's skins, and then he gives them a new skin so he can rip off their skin again. He pours molten pitch down their mouths. Allah is really sadistic in torturing peaceful Muslims and non-Muslims in hell. Now, fortunately, Allah is Satan, and while he is in hell, there will be no opportunity for him to impose those specific kinds of tortures. As it relates to the Christian depiction, it's always fire and it's physical torture in fire. Well, fire is a form of light, so there cannot be any fire in hell. There can be anguish in hell, and there is, but the anguish in hell is perpetrated by the fellow inmates in hell, demonic spirits, Satan, and the elitist who are going to be incarcerated there, those who have led people away from God. It's not God doing any of this. God is expressly prohibited from entering Sheol. He can't go there. That's because it's the place separated from him. That's why Yosha had to give up the spirit, which is that part of him that made him partly God, before his soul could go into Sheol to ransom us from our sins. God's spirit cannot enter Sheol. It's the place separated from him. And so this Christian depiction of a place of torture is also invalid, because God describes Sheol as a lightless place. You can't have fire in a lightless place. Fire, the reference of fire is simply the metaphor that speaks of something that refines and tests and consumes, so that it's always the metaphor for judgment. So en route to Sheol, there is the symbolism of the fire, which is judgment. Light being shed on evil, and evil being consumed by the presence of the light. Now, the other part of Sheol that differs from hell is that Christians will tell you that every soul either goes to heaven or hell. But if a God says, love me, or I'm going to send you to hell where you'll be tortured forever, that God would be sadistic. The Christian God, therefore, is sadistic. That's not a rational approach. And Yahweh says no such thing. Yahweh says for 6,997 years of human existence, from the time that we were booted out of the garden to the time that we returned to it, that you are free to make your own choice. You can accept what I'm offering. You can reject what I'm offering. You can even oppose what I'm offering. You can be ignorant of what I'm offering. If you accept it, you get to live with me forever. If you reject it, are ignorant of it, or don't care about it, when you die, you die. There is no consequence. You don't go to heaven. You don't go to hell. Your soul simply ceases to exist. And that's the vast preponderance of people. And then he says, for those who lead people astray, for those that diminish the importance of his name and who corrupt his testimony, that for leading people to lifelessness, they will endure an eternity in Sheol, which is defined as this black hole. Now, I mentioned that there's 3 years where that will not be the case. Your last time to exercise free will, should you remain here on earth after the beginning of the tribulation, you'll have 3.5 years even during the tribulation to exercise free will. But at the end of the tribulation, when the beast is free to manipulate as he wishes, when we enter the most despicable time in the whole human experience. At that point, you're either with God or against Him. At that point, there are God will make Himself absolutely known to everyone. He says, I'm going to lift up my banner on the mountain and everyone's going to see it. I'm going to blow my shofar and everyone's going to hear it. You're going to hear who I am. You're going to see who I am. You're going to see what I'm offering. You're going to hear exactly what is at stake. And at that point, you get a chance to vote. Free will exists right up to that moment. And at that moment, you enter a period where you're either with God or opposed to Him. So that's what's at stake here. Yes, go ahead, Glenn.
You mentioned the blowing of the show, the final blowing of the shofar. Interestingly enough, I have to go, but this is a parting shot. I wanted to couldn't resist this. Oh, and one of the news segments, they mentioned that the blowing of the shofar with today's day of prayer. Now, they've recently reopened the Washington Monument, so next year for the day of prayer, they want to use the Washington Monument as a minaret instead.
Oh, yeah, it's just perfect. Why not? Yes, as it plays homage to pagan sun gods of yesteryear and is a tribute to the Freemasons' influence in the creation of the American politic today. What better use of a way to corrupt something that Yahweh has inspired? We'll return to the final segment in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. As Yahweh completes his depiction of what hell will be like and his notification that everyone who has leagued with the elitist, who have worked against his people, especially in religion, politics, and in the military, he then turns to his children. And he says, at this time, she, that's not speaking of his children, that's speaking of our spiritual mother, the set-apart spirit. At this time, she shall direct and guide him. Who's him? Him would be Jacob. We've returned to the very beginning of this, where Yahweh introduces Jacob to us. Jacob represents two things. One is the children of Yisrael. He was named Yisrael, and his descendants formed the 12 tribes of Yisrael. This is racial Israel. Jacob also represents the country of the nation of Israel, and he also represents what Israel represents, which are individuals who engage and endure with God. He is therefore the embodiment of the covenant. At this time, she shall direct and guide him, delivering him as a gift which is agreeable, one born out of reverence and respect, to approach Yahweh of the vast array of spiritual implements. People who have become family, who were arrogant but are now in an altered state and willing to follow, enabling them to be drawn out and carried away, and who were perverse but now have been scrubbed clean, will come out of a nation feared from here to there and beyond in this future time, a population which is comprised of many races from many different places with a strange foreign language, talking down to others while continually marching off to war based on their condescending rhetoric, always trying to impose its influence, establishing the rules, eagerly throwing inhabitants out of their land, aggressively subduing others, whose country is divided by rivers. They will be brought to a place, speaking of Jacob, the covenant, and the Israelites, will be brought to a place of the name of Yahweh. Where's the name of Yahweh? Where's a place that bears Yahweh's name? Yahudah. We've corrupted to Judah. Yahudah. It means to relate to Yahweh and to be related to Yahweh. It happens to be the area of Yisrael given to the tribe of Yahudah that surrounds Jerusalem. They will be brought to the place that bears Yahweh's name, to the Mount of Sion, which is the sign posted to identify the way. God is, he put up his ensign, he says, this is my sign on my mountain, and I'm raising this so that you can see who I am, so that you can read what I am offering you. And now he's bringing his children out of America and bringing them to the signpost along the way, which is Mount Zion, one of the three mountains in Jerusalem, along with the Mount of Olives, which is symbol for the Spirit, the Mount of Mount Moriah, which means to revere Yah, which is where the Torah was manifest before our eyes and fulfilled, and then Mount Zion, which speaks of God providing this signpost, these signs along the way to him. This is what has been conveyed. This will be this declaration that Yah was making on our behalf. Now, there's two ways to interpret the timing of this. One is that since half of the Jewish population in the world, it's a little less than that, 42% of the Jewish population in the world resides in America, 42% resides in Israel. The remaining 16% reside in other countries, that God has already protected and has declared his protection of Yehudim and Yisrael, but now he is also gathering in so that he can protect the Yehudim, the Yisraelites in America, and bringing them to the promised land. That's one way to interpret this. The other way to interpret this is that when Yah said that when Israel was thinned at the waist, that he was committing to harvest his children, to glean them, to take a percentage of them. And he said that it might be 4 to 5 of them from a faraway place that had been separated, and then combine them with those who were being harvested in Yisrael. These could speak of those individuals being harvested at the time of the Teruah harvest.